Rob Wolf, Andy D's back for episode 10. How are you?
I'm good. Survived the Nicaraguan roadways with Wellborn at the wheel.
Yeah, I think there was some question whether or not you were going to make it back.
Oh, I was definitely questioning whether or not we would make it back. Apparently, Wellborn has gone through several, technical driving schools and stuff like that, like race car schools, and he was driving the Suzuki Samurai rig that we had as if it were a race car. So it was horrifying.
I can only envision this. This is why I don't vacation in parts of the world like that, unless I would never have to drive or maybe not even get in a car, you know?
Yeah,
maybe
if it was going through a demilitarized zone to get to your vacation spot is maybe not for the faint of heart, but it was pretty fun. Just wanted to thank all the listeners. We've had a stratospheric increase in listeners. We went from 4 to 6. And that is largely still in the rest home population. They're using this podcast as a cure for insomnia. So thank you to all 6 of you listening.
And to be clear, we have no scientific method for calculating the listeners. So that's purely anecdotal or pseudoscience, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Chicken giblets. Chicken giblets to figure out how many people are listening to us.
Exactly. And hopefully all 6 are still on the line.
Ready?
All right, so we've got a ton of questions. In fact, I think over the holidays, which was interesting, there was what seemed to be an increase in questions to catch up on, which was surprising. I would have thought it would have gone the other way, but I think folks had a little bit more free time to give some things some thought and pose some interesting questions.
Yeah, the questions are up. We're actually getting some rotator questions. On iTunes, the front page rotator has been the Paleolithic solution several times, so we're getting some pretty good traffic. So thank you to everybody for the questions and for the interest. Very, very exciting.
Yeah. And also, I think what's interesting, too, is we're getting, I don't want to call them repeat questions, but some interesting questions with slightly different dimensions that maybe we haven't addressed in the past. And so I think it's interesting is that answering questions sometimes is causing more interesting and complicated questions, which is good news. Wait till our supplement episode that we're teasing, because I feel like that's going to have a 17-part spinoff.
Yeah, it'll be worse than when I gave the protein prescription and the number of calories to calculate the protein prescription and all that. So, yeah, I'm living in stark terror of when we do the podcast on supplements.
Or worse than your 10-minute dairy dissertation last week.
Yes.
All right. Well, anyway, I think we'll jump into the questions. Enough rambling from you and I. First, we have a rather lengthy question from multi-part question from our friend Christina from the gym. First question's about eggs. Basically we had talked in the autoimmune episode, I think episode 5, we talked a little bit about staying clear of grains and legumes and especially eggs. I think we've addressed why we don't like eggs related to folks with autoimmune issues pretty clearly. But she did ask a question, which I thought was interesting at the end, was if you have an insulin resistance problem, should you stay clear of eggs? She goes on to say this last question plays on her curiosity if insulin-resistant problems can lead to or are related to autoimmune problems.
Yeah, so just to recap, the stuff that we're really looking at with autoimmunity is any type of a gut irritant. And so obviously the top of that list is going to be any type of grains and legumes, obviously more gluten-containing grains, wheat, rye, oats, barley, all that sort of stuff, higher than corn and rice, although all grains, all legumes are potentially problematic in this regard. Then we start expanding out from there, and we see things like nightshades, like potatoes, tomatoes, eggplants, hot peppers. Those can also be gut irritants. Egg, interestingly, also has a high potential for gut irritation in that the egg white contains a protein called lysozyme. Lysozyme is designed to slice up and break down foreign types of protein, and this is to prevent the egg from being predated or invaded by bacteria and stuff like that. Well, it also happens to, if we undercooked egg whites or even just egg whites in general, there's a potential for that lysozyme to cause gut irritation, and it causes some rather spectacular gut irritation in certain folks. So this is that shotgun approach where if we have somebody who has an autoimmune condition, suspects they have an autoimmune condition, has a lot of systemic inflammation, we kind of just throw out this big, broad-reaching net, cut out the grains, cut out the legumes, cut out the dairy, also reduce your egg consumption. We would probably throw most nuts and seeds in that camp also, maybe the exception being coconut, as coconut actually has some gut healing effects. And so that's the whole kind of totality of the autoimmune thing. Grains, legumes, dairy, eggs, nuts and seeds. Go free on that stuff for a month so that we can try to reestablish some health, see if you get some improvements out of that shotgun approach, and then you can start playing with the type of stuff and the frequency of reintroduction and see how that affects your symptoms. So that's kind of the autoimmune side. So now the question that relates to the insulin resistance and whether or not that plays into autoimmunity, all of this stuff is remarkably, unfortunately, for lack of a better term, chicken and egg. It's autoimmunity can play into insulin resistance in that inflammation, oxidative damage can damage insulin signaling. Similarly, the process of having too high of insulin in and of itself can cause oxidative stress and increased inflammation that can then be precipitating or exacerbating of autoimmunity. So these things are very, very synergistic. Simply experiencing disturbed sleep for a couple of days can make one autoimmune. So things that are environmentally irritating that would be subclinical, that would be subacute, under a situation of high insulin resistance caused by a lack of sleep, even can make one more responsive. So like cat dander or ragweed or stuff like that, we find that allergies are much, much worse in people that have high systemic inflammation in general, have insulin resistance, and sleep is another causative factor. So this is kind of an interesting thing in which we just sidestep any type of food at all, and we just have an environmental insult that is caused by a lack of sleep that can exacerbate both insulin resistance and autoimmunity. So it's all very, very interrelated, and it gets kind of tough to delineate what's causing what. We have a question later that's related to insulin and insulin resistance, and I'm going to talk about leptin and the role that leptin plays in all this stuff. And it's as complex as all get out. It's sometimes hard to keep clear what is causing what, but it's very, very clear that these things are synergistic and at least additive and maybe multiplicative. Like they may actually multiply each other.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to your topic you touched on in the beginning there, sort of that shotgun approach, because as you said, some of these things are synergistic, they're interrelated. It's hard to exactly say what is the driving force behind causing some of these things. Try to pull everything out, you know, fix the sleep, fix all that stuff. And then as far as food goes, you can start to kind of potentially reintroduce certain things and see how you respond.
Absolutely, yeah. And this is also where it's tough sometimes to get a concrete scientific study to support some of this stuff, because you don't know which factor is the issue for a given individual. And so that's where the outcome-based approaches become kind of the gold standard. You know, it's give this stuff a shot. We understand from various sources, both anecdotal and research-based, that these things may be factors. Let's cover all of our bases, and then via elimination, you know, reverse elimination by reintroduction, you can figure out to what degree these things are problems and to, you know, what your exposure rate can be under a given circumstance and still be asymptomatic. Or you can just go wild and do whatever you want to do. But at least, you know, that's all up to you then. But at least you've kind of mapped out what that scenario looks like.
Perfect. Yeah, that's a good question. All right, next we have another one of our chia seed questions. And I think last week we talked about a chia seed product, although I'm not sure we clearly kind of illuminated, you know, that we were talking about chia seeds per se. So let's hit this one more time. So basically Christina said a few weeks ago she asked about chia seeds after finding out they were high in omega-3s. She recalls Rob said that they also contained omega-6s. However, after looking further into it, she noticed that chia seeds have a 3-to-1 ratio in favor of omega-3s. If I continue to take them, will I completely raise my omega-6 levels too high while assuming I'm continuing to eat a good paleo diet?
And this is, you know, really good question. The omega-3s in the chia seeds, again, are that short chain, that 18-carbon linolenic acid, and we are very, very inefficient at converting that into EPA and DHA, the longer chain omega-3s. And there's some other side problems with that. When we start ramping up the conversion of the omega-3s, we also upregulate the conversion of omega-6s. And so the end sum of this is that, again, if somebody is like vegan, if they're just not taking in omega-3s at all, you know, in the EPA DHA form, then I would sign off on chia seeds, I'd sign off on flax seeds, that stuff's fine. But in general, I don't really see this stuff being a great option for folks if they are not averse to taking fish oil, and probably more beneficial even than that is trying to seek out like grass-fed meat and omega-3 eggs and wild-caught fish. Trying to get as much of that stuff dietarily as you can, I think, is a great way to go. So her question is, will she in total raise her levels of omega-6? No, I don't think so. But because of the short-chain omega-3s, I think that there's still that potential for kind of screwing up that omega-3, omega-6 ratio and causing some other pro-inflammatory side effects because of front-loading those short-chain omega-3s and omega-6s. And I think we talked pretty good length about that in a previous podcast.
So let me turn this around a little bit. So say for some reason I love chia seeds and I'm obsessed with them. I don't even know what a chia seed tastes like. All I think about is those little Chia Pets commercials that we used to see growing up. But anyway.
Chia Garcia, yeah. Yeah.
If I was to consume those in moderation, say maybe I like to sprinkle them on my veggies or something, would you have any issue with that? You know, not saying, hey, I'm taking this as a high dosage supplement. Potentially, I just kind of like the taste of them. I like to add it to certain meals. What's your perspective on that?
I think throwing in like a tablespoon here and there of either chia seeds or flax seeds are fine. I don't know about the chia seeds, but the flax seeds actually have some anti-estrogenic effects. They actually have some long chain fats in them that and mucilaginous stuff that binds to estrogens and they can remove them out of the body. And so they're kind of good for that. It's good for like prostate issue protocols. Paulikin uses them in that regard, but he's not using them for the omega-3s. So if you want to supplement them on a conservative basis, I think that's fine. I think both chia seeds and flax seeds taste horrible. They have that kind of reminiscent moldy fish kind of taste to them because these short chain fats, like essentially linseed oil, is a highly, highly refined form of flaxseed oil. And I think most folks are familiar with the fact that if you take linseed oil, put it on a rag and leave it out in the air, that rag can actually catch on fire. And that is from how quickly these short chain, highly polyunsaturated fats, how oxidizable they are, how massively they react, even just with the atmospheric oxygen and room temperature levels of heat. This stuff goes bad very, very quickly, and you're potentially introducing these short-chain saturated fats that are of kind of dubious utility and definitely impose an oxidative load. So I'm just really... I'm pressed as to find a good argument for supplementing with that stuff at any real high level.
Cool. All right. I'm not going to pick up any chia seeds this week, Rob, but...
I doubt if the folks that sent me the chia seeds are very happy with me, but, well, they're a CrossFit Games sponsor. Maybe we'll find some love there.
No comment. Next, Christina goes on to talk about fish oil. She says, in one of the episodes, you approach the most cost-effective way of purchasing your fish oil. In one question another listener asked, they inquired about the yield of Kirkland brand fish oil of the capsule versus taking swigs of liquid fish oil from the bottle. In the end, you still recommended going with the Kirkland signature brand of fish oil because it was more cost-effective and yielded the same amount as liquid fish oil. You've also mentioned in your free nutrition talks that one could get their daily intake of fish oil by eating 3 cans of sardines a day. So which yields more from the source? Kirkland brand fish oils, fish oil liquid, or 3 cans of sardines with eyeballs and all?
I have not seen many sardines that are eyeballs and all.
Although we would eat them, probably.
I would certainly eat them. The cost effectiveness on this definitely falls squarely with Kirkland. Kirkland stuff is the most cost effective way to get your dose of omega-3s out of all this stuff. The reason why I mention the sardines is that people start hand-wringing and bellyaching about, like, oh, I have to take 8 or 10, you know, fish oil capsules with each meal. And so I just point out that they could get this stuff from a dietary source and that it's really not that crazy an amount of omega-3s that we're supplementing. You could get this stuff dietarily from, like, grass-fed meat or fattier types of cold water fish. It's just those things aren't always accessible, or people don't like them that much. The fact that Christina is mentioning eyeballs and all, you kind of get the sense that she's not a big fan of the sardines. So that's why I mentioned these real easy accessible dietary sources. If you are willing to forego a little bit of the cost, you know, pay a little bit more but have convenience, then a liquid fish oil like the Carlson stuff is by far the most convenient way to get stuff done. So what we're looking at here is kind of a spectrum of convenience, cost, efficacy, and all that sort of jive. I would probably throw the sardines plus a little bit of liquid fish oil as being the best way to get it. The Kirkland stuff is inexpensive and I think relatively good. I still don't know how much a short chain omega-3 they've added to their mix. And they definitely have changed what their label says. Used to, it said a given amount of omega-3s yielding this much EPA and DHA. They no longer say that. They just say that it contains this, you know, X amount of omega-3s. And then, you know, I think that they're getting a little slick on that. There could be a significant amount of short chain, you know, 18-carbon omega-3 in that. Haven't investigated that yet. So that's definitely an issue. And we need to do a little investigating on that to figure out what the story is.
Yeah, and I think continuing on that line of thought, she goes on to say that the back of the Kirkland's bottle says it attains, you know, a certain amount of soy. Is that a problem since soy is not encouraged on the paleo diet?
You know, when we're talking about lecithin or some stuff like that, I mean, it makes life so much easier. Unless you have a real gnarly soy allergy, I think it's fine. Things like soy lecithin are totally good to go. If they are using soybean oil as a means of propping up their omega-3s, then I'm going to have a real big problem with that because it's a super cheap, crappy form of omega-3s.
Yeah, and I think this is one where back in one of the earlier comments on one of the show notes or a comment someone provided on one of our episodes, someone had done a very nice analysis of like all the major fish oils and cost per gram of EPA and DHA. So I will grab that link and throw it in the show notes because it was pretty interesting. Clearly, someone spent a lot of time doing that. And so, you know, I think that's helpful for folks. I finally, bit the bullet and went to the liquid, went to the Carlson's. And I'll tell you, my life is much more pleasurable since I don't have to swallow large amounts of pills with my meals.
Yeah, and the lemon-flavored stuff is actually reasonably yummy, and it's very, very easy to get a dose of it down in, like, a significant amount.
Yeah, yeah, big fan, although I think it tastes good, actually, so.
Yeah.
But then again, we like sardines from the can, so.
Indeed,
we have problems. Okay, so we'll put that comparison link in the show notes because I thought that was cool.
Cool.
Next question, we got a question about body composition and nutrition. In your first or second episode, you talked about Johnny's skinny britches and what he would have to do to gain weight. You went into some detail about what one should do if someone wants to lean out. I just need to get some clarification on what you recommend for leaning out but still gaining strength. Is it the high-fat, low-carb way for someone looking to lean out? From what I understand, if you choose the higher-fat, low-carb, high, low-glycemic vegetable, high-lean protein, low-insulin-spiking foods, low to no dairy, that one can lean out substantially with the downside of a decrease in performance. Is this performance decrease a temporary adjustment, or will I at some point in time be able to keep the leanness but gain the strength after the adjustment period?
Holy cats, that's a lot of questions. That was like six other questions within the sub-question. So the overall question here is, like, can I continue to improve my strength while leaning out? I think is kind of the, you know, boil this whole thing down. That really depends on who we're talking about. If we have somebody who's comparatively new to training, and Christine, I would throw in that because I think she's been with us at NorCal about 6 months. She still is a novice lifter, and therefore, like, we should be able to lean her out, continue to push her linear strength progression, which is what we do in all of our, you know, on-ramp elements, level one classes. We're always pushing that linear strength development because virtually all of our clients, even the people who've been with us 2 to 3 years, are still what you would consider a novice, at best an intermediate strength athlete. They still have not finished the linear progression that they can have on something like a starting strength program or max effort black box, which we use the kind of max effort black box templates in our gym. So she should be able to lean out in a moderate protein, higher fat, you know, low-ish carb kind of approach mixed with linear strength progression, I think is really the smart way to go no matter how you're tackling a lean out program, because nobody really wants to either lose muscle or lose strength in the process of that. If we have a more advanced athlete, we're likely to see some sort of a performance degradation in the loss of body weight because it inevitably and unfortunately, you usually see some amount of muscle mass loss on that, even on a real low-carb, you know, higher-protein diet. That will depend on how caloric restricted you are, how much protein you're taking in, what what type of training you're doing. But generally, what we find is a stronger, more advanced athlete, we will see some absolute strength decreases with a loss in body weight in general.
All right. Christina, you have you're not short in wording. I'm just going to say that.
Nope. Gift gab when chatting her up in the gym or she's writing a question down. So,
although she did say in the beginning, which I forgot to read, is that she had quite a few questions, which might take a while to answer. So feel free to read this by the toilet.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on. She's been eating more fat, which she loves, and she believes herself to be leaning out. She hasn't had any of the negative side effects as mentioned in episode 5. She goes on to say she believes that she might have said that there was a possibility that she might not consume enough calories in a day eating so much fat. Since she's increased her fat intake, her hunger is that of an anorexic model with a dime bag habit without the birdcage look. Wow. Sometimes she can literally skip meals because she's so full. How do you recommend eating enough calories in a day if the hunger response isn't there? I've heard that you should only eat when you're hungry, but if that was the case, I would only be eating 1.5 to 2 times a day. Let's play it up and say that I also would not be eating any starchy vegetables or insulin-spiking foods.
This is a good, interesting question. Like, if we really sat back and let our hunger drive our consumption, you know, this is what, you know, one of Art Devaney's deals. Don't eat unless you're hungry. Maybe, you know, wait until you're a little bit hungry even and kind of drive that along. If we really kind of wrap our brain around that, folks suddenly get very, very lean. Maybe you don't get huge. Maybe we're not producing bodybuilders. Maybe we're not producing 240-pound power lifters and stuff like that. But people tend to be lean. They tend to be strong. They tend to have amazing blood lipid numbers and all that sort of jive. I know for myself, because of this constant fixation with trying to get bigger, I just tend to eat more and more often than really what my body would drive me to normally do. And if left to my own devices, it'd probably be 2 to 3 meals a day, and that's about it. And I think that that's probably fine. I think your body has a pretty good ability to tell you when and what you need to eat. And interestingly, when we start doing this kind of lower carb, higher protein, lots of non-starchy veggies kind of approach to stuff, people aren't that hungry. Like they just don't get that hungry. And even if they go several hours without eating, they're usually pretty good to go. Where I will see this change a little bit is when people start exercising more, they get more and more active, then they will tend to get hungrier. But this is just that matching of energy output with energy intake, and it's all regulated by hunger. Both Art Devaney and Gary Taubes talk at length about this, and it's one of the perplexing conundrums of attempting to lean out or affect some sort of fat loss without some insulin control, is that, you know, as you start exercising more, you tend to see a lockstep increase with hunger. And it can be a bugger to lean people out if you're not really, really tackling the insulin side of things. We probably won't get to this question for a couple of weeks, but a guy posted a question from a guy that has a blog. It's like the No BS Nutrition blog. And the dude looks pretty interesting, but this guy actually mentioned that high insulin levels are anorexic, that they actually shut down hunger, which I need to do some investigating on that, because a bunch of the other guys' stuff looks pretty solid, but this seemed like the most paradoxical thing that I've ever heard. You know, like all of my experience, everything I've seen, is if you have low insulin levels, you have very, very low hunger. It's just like an if A, then B sort of thing. So I don't know that this is particularly bad. I think if your body is telling you that you want to eat 1.5 to 2 times a day, that's probably fine. We would dial it back and say, how do you look? How do you feel? How do you perform? And if you're failing in one of those areas, then we might need to step up your food and fuel differently.
Yeah, because I think, you know, for me personally, I fall into the camp, and I think some of it's some lifestyle cortisol stuff, whereas that if I don't force myself to eat more than, you know, 1 or 2 times a day, I'm literally never hungry. But in no way do I then see kind of this increase in performance. And I think we'll talk about it a little bit in Christina's next question, but I think your point about look, feel, perform, you know, tracking some type of, you know, max strength markers or some periodic maybe benchmark workouts you come back to can kind of help, you know, dial some of this stuff in. Am I still seeing improvements with what I'm currently doing, or do I need to, you know, look at the outcomes and maybe adjust some things? Because maybe 1 to 2 times a day is totally fine. You know, maybe it's not. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I know, like, Pavel and a lot of his dudes, they do, like, a kind of a anabolic diet sort of gig where they're generally, like, high protein, high fat, maybe one big carb meal a week, but they're tending to do like a meal a day, you know, maybe 2 meals a day. It's a pretty good sized meal when they eat, but they seem to do pretty good on that. And if you're into the whole wiry strength crowd, then I think that it's totally legit. And I think those guys are going to age well and be healthy. And, you know, when we think about like intermittent fasting and all this other stuff, and if you do it in a way where, like you said, we're not whacking ourselves with a ton of cortisol, it's probably pretty darn healthy. And it certainly is easy. I know I want to, like, blow my brains out sometimes, like, you know, cooking several meals a day when you get busy and you're doing a bunch of other stuff. It's just, frankly, a pain in the ass. So,
yeah, if there was a pill for food, it would be easier. And last question from Christina. She said, Andy mentioned something about producing too much cortisol if you work out too much while not getting enough rest in between workouts. She's debating whether or not to increase her current 3 times a week crossfitting to 4 times a week. I don't want to do too much and have it negatively affect me or hurt my performance. Other than overtraining injuries, are there signs to watch out for if you are releasing too much cortisol?
Folks, you know, signs of overtraining, you start getting some sleep disturbance, I think is one of the very first things that pops up, kind of like a rapid heartbeat when going to bed, or rapid heartbeat throughout the day. You'll just kind of click into a mode where heartbeat is kind of racing. Can't turn off your brain at night, rapid heartbeat, not waking up, rested or refreshed. Then that can start turning into a kind of paradoxical or reversed cortisol deal. We should have higher cortisols naturally in the morning, and then they should decrease towards the evening. And so that would mean that ideally you would wake up refreshed, alert, ready to roll, and then as day wears on, you get tired, and then in the evening you're tired, you lay down, go to bed, and all is good. When people start driving into later stages of adrenal fatigue, they'll be very, very tired and lethargic in the AM and more alert at night. Paradoxically, which obviously doesn't do any good for your sleep situation. So that's all stuff that, you know, you can track and kind of keep an eye on. I think watching sleep is a very, very good indicator of whether or not you're training too hard. When we trained Glenn Cordoza and some other, like, legitimate athletes that are really pushing the work output very, very high. That's kind of the first thing that I'm looking at when they come in for a session. How'd you sleep last night? And if their sleep was disturbed the night before, we usually do an easy row, foam roll, stretch, mobility work, and send them home. Like when we start driving them into overtraining, then I dial them back. I think in Christina's situation, if she wanted to add a fourth day a week, I would do like the O-lifting class. I would do something that was more strength and technique oriented. Our general, I don't know if we can even still call them CrossFit classes, our NorCal classes, functional high-intensity classes, you know, we do something like a max effort black box, which is a strength session that involves like pressing, deadlifting, squatting, weighted pull-ups, rope climbs, basic gymnastic skills in the beginning, and then we do some sort of a time-indexed, short-ish WOD at the end, kind of classic metabolic conditioning, circuit training sort of deal, and that'll range anywhere from like 5 to 15 minutes for the most part. And I think that that's a real modest approach, but also very, very effective, like minimum input, maximum return. If I were to do a fourth day a week, I would make it a dedicated strength day, especially we're in a facility that offers solid O-lifting coaching. So if you've got a dedicated class where you could go get O-lifting, gymnastics, powerlifting instruction, then I would jump on that and develop that strength and technical base.
Yeah, and you know, I think what's interesting about this question too, and you know, Rutt actually brought it up at the Max Effort Black Box seminar we went to, which I hadn't actually thought about in a long time, but I recall in the early Glassman stuff you saw this, and it's also pretty prevalent in Doug McGuff, who's, you know, Ultimate Exercise, kind of the you know, on the extreme end of the HIIT movement, you know, one set to failure, whatever. But anytime people start talking about adding extra days of exercise, we always kind of go back to sort of the drug prescription dose response thing, you know. It's like, in general, more movement is probably better. But I think, you know, Rutt brought up the question, especially as some of his clients got older, you know, what was the minimum amount of work they could do to see improvement or maintain fitness, as opposed to sort of what is the maximum amount they could sustain or support over time?
Totally. And you see this, and you know, we have a question at the end from a guy that we'll kind of wrap back around to this. Art Devaney, Clarence Bass, a lot of people have really adopted this approach of like, what's my minimum input for maximum return? And I think a lot of Devaney stuff is like really spot on, like those hierarchical sets, alactic sets. Man, that stuff is money. It's kind of minimum investment, maximum return. Very, very smart. And you look at what Rutt's doing, all these things kind of start migrating towards to use more Devaney stuff, an attractor, which in economic terms is, you know, if you were to make a graph, it's what drags a graph towards a particular endpoint. And so when we're talking about like kind of dynamic or flowing systems, instead of things changing all the time, attractors tend to drag things towards an endpoint. And what we see in the regards to training, there's definitely a diminishing return with regards to higher and higher workloads of training. And this is that point of inflection also, I would think, between like generalist health-oriented training, you know, fitness-oriented training versus athletics. And the difference between first place and second place is in athletics, legitimate athletics, are you know, tiny, tiny margins, and so you need to train 6 days a week, 7 days a week, multiple sessions, multiple variables going on. For the generalist individual, though, they can get quite a ways down the road, an impressive distance down the road, with a relatively curtailed training program.
Yeah. And I think in general, too, you know, it brings you back to the, you know, kind of Mark Sisson primal blueprint. He's got the high intensity piece or the, you know, strength base, but he also sort of has the, you know, the sort of move frequently and at a slow pace. And I think you see a lot of that stuff in Devaney's, and even, you know, I remember Rutt talking about, you know, some of his clients and off days, he's just having them do some of the warm up stuff they do just to keep them moving, but not drastically increase, you know, workload or stress on the body.
Yeah, totally.
So, yeah, really, really good question. All right, Christina, that was an impressive list of questions. Thank you.
We'll live in fear of the next round of questions.
Don't take it personally. Nothing but love. Anyway,
she's one of our favorite clients. So, exactly. Yeah.
All right. Next, we got a question from Chris, who is Norwegian. So I assume this is, you know, he ends his question by, if my English is bad or unclear, I blame it on the fact that I'm Norwegian. So thank you for that laugh. That was good.
I blame mine on the fact that I'm Californian.
So. Northern Californian.
Yeah, Northern California.
Exactly. All right, so a little background. 23 years old, been doing CrossFit and some gymnastics and O-lifting 3 to 5 times a week for the last year and a half. Getting more and more serious. Great improvement the whole time. 2 months ago, he's 178, fairly lean and 6 feet tall. Started zoning, 16 blocks with double fat. He lost 8 pounds, got a lot leaner. So lean, you know, lean as he basically ever wanted to be. So I guess someday I'll achieve that. And he set some new PRs and everything. For instance, 839 Elizabeth. They even had a slight improvement in his total. So anyway, after consulting others with his at the affiliate, reading the Rob Wolf blog, he went paleo, you know, cutting down on no cottage cheese, dropping the fruit, you know, only occasional rice and oats. Currently eating about 18 blocks protein, 8 blocks carbs, 54 blocks fat with 8 extra carb blocks on workout days. Okay, so on to the questions. His goal is basically CrossFit performance, wants to participate in the sectionals with a goal to reach the regionals. So, question one, how much protein? He's been adding in some max effort black box before his CrossFit WODs. He also does some additional CrossFit football WODs. He wants to add strength without sacrificing too much. You mentioned in the last podcast that 1 gram per pound of body weight for max strength, but how would that fit into his plan? Do you only increase protein but leave the rest unchanged? And my favorite part of the question, in the last CrossFit Journal video, Barry Sears said that 45 grams of protein was the maximum in a given meal. What are your thoughts?
Holy cow. Well, you know, it sounds like he's done a great job of establishing a phenomenal base level of fitness. He's lean, he's strong, he probably has great hormonal response. This is like the ideal person that you then start doing some real just potent tinkering with, you know, and I would love to see it. It's great. I see this max effort black box kind of thing there. I would pretty much double his protein, and then I would about double his fat intake and probably keep the carbs about the same. Because at 6 feet, 178 pounds, he's kind of, you know, wiry, strong, athletic and all that. But I think just from a Rip is very articulate on this thing. When you increase the cross-sectional size of a muscle, like your quads, your biceps, your triceps, all that sort of stuff, you dramatically improve the leverage that you get out of those muscles. And so sticking just a little bit of extra muscle on this kid is likely to dramatically improve his work capacity. Bigger engine, you know, roughly the same size chassis, but bigger engine, then he's going to be great to go. And I think that that's a smart place to start. He's going to be at about a gram of protein per pound of body weight at that point. He's going to increase his calories in total. He's probably going to be, think about that, he's going to be about 3,800 to 4,000 calories a day. He should see some pretty nice uptick in both his muscle size and his strength and all that. He might even move that stuff up further, but I think that that would be a great place to start.
Yeah. Any thoughts on the 45 gram of protein maximum?
It's just ridiculous. I mean, it's kind of funny. Barry Sears throws out some zingers that are easy to put to bed and don't really lend much to his or the overall scene's credibility. So keep going, Bear.
All right. Question two, what types of fat? He usually gets his fats from oil and nuts. He uses coconut oil and thinks it has a great taste. But why is it so favorable? It has lots of saturated fat, and I really don't know why it's good.
It is a saturated fat, but it's that medium-chain triglyceride, so we've got a little bit of different stuff going on with regards to the potential of inflammation, whereas like a palmitic acid does have some potential for some increased inflammation and some increased LDL particle count. Coconut oil, not really the same issue there. So it's delicious. The fact that it is a saturated fat makes it a very, very low oxidative potential. So unlike, like canola oil actually has quite a bit of omega-3 and omega-6 fats in it, so it's got a high reactivity. So the coconut oil is just, it's tasty, it's heat stable, it's a kind of a nice variety. Olive oil obviously is great too, but just big fan of the coconut oil.
Yeah, and I think actually maybe a few days ago also, I know this question was on the Paleo Diet blog, so Lauren Cordain's blog. So if folks don't read that, I would check that out. I think he and Pedro Bastez also responded to the question about why their thoughts on coconut oil.
Perfect.
Yeah, so definitely a good blog if folks haven't checked that out. And then the next question from Chris, and I think you just touched on it a little bit, but thoughts on canola oil versus olive oil?
Definitely the olive oil. The canola oil is higher in omega-3s and omega-6s. Olive oil is heavy in omega-6. It has some omega-6 in it, but if you're using it as a cooking oil, it just makes me nervous to heat up any type of oil that has a ton of polyunsaturated fat in it. And canola oil definitely has more than olive oil.
Yeah. And then last one on this one, is there any gain in buying the expensive olive oils?
God, they taste great. My wife just chimed in. They taste great. They do have a ton of phenolics, like these really interesting like anti-estrogen compounds, highly antioxidant. I don't know. Like, I don't know the guy's situation. If he's some starving student and he ends up paying $50 for a liter of really good olive oil, then maybe it's not worth it versus just getting like some standard stuff. It's tough to speak as to whether or not the expensive stuff is a good option or not. It's real subjective as to what the person's situation is.
Yeah, and this is one for myself. We tend to kind of roll with some standard, you know, regular cheaper stuff when we're cooking with it. But if it's something that we're actually going to be able to taste the flavor on a salad or something, I always have, you know, one or two small bottles of the nice, expensive, very tasty olive oil to use for that stuff.
Yeah, and that's a great way to do it.
Yeah. All right, good. Next question on turnips and rutabaga. I haven't seen rutabaga in a while. I understand that root-fed vegetables in general aren't that favorable. Both potatoes and carrots are a no-no. But what about turnips and rutabaga? As far as I know, they do not contain that much sugar, and I can't find much info about them. Are they preferred over fruit or not at all?
I would generally say that, you know, turnips, rutabagas, and carrots also are definitely preferable over fruit because of the low or non-existent fructose content. These root vegetables are actually fantastic for a post-workout meal, for a carb-up meal if you're on kind of a cyclic low-carb plan, or just if you're just generally eating paleo, I think that they're a pretty good option. Because of the carbohydrate density, they can be overdone, so somebody who's endeavoring towards fat loss should minimize these types of items. But I think in general, they're pretty good to go. Potatoes don't really land in that camp because of some of the gut-irritating characteristics that they have. So, you know, I would eat a potato over toast any day because I think that they're much more benign than like, gluten-containing items. But as compared to, like, turnips, rutabagas, beets, carrots, all that sort of jive, I think those are better.
Yeah. I don't know why everyone hates the carrots.
You know, it was all a Barry Sears deal. Like, those were, like, a huge no-no on the zone, and so then everybody's been hating on the carrots since then.
Yeah, and I think I recall my favorite Melissa Urban, now Byers, blog post was something along the lines of titled On the Crazy Train to Carrot Town, basically. It included her dissertation about why is everyone hating on the carrots.
Exactly. a wise, wise woman.
Exactly. All right, question four, never full and cheat meals versus cheat days. I think we'll address a little bit, we addressed a little bit this with Rob's idea of increasing, you know, protein and fat intake. But after a meal, even post-workout with 5 blocks protein, 8 blocks carbs, 15 blocks fat, he never feels full. He's not directly hungry anymore, but still never full. That's a bit hard mentally. Any tips? A cheat meal could be 2 to 3 times a normal dinner, and then I'll be satisfied. There were 2 cheat meal questions on the last podcast, but what do you think about having some more cheat meals throughout the week versus one whole cheat day a week?
You know, where he's at with this 5 protein, 8 carbs, 15 fat, say like in the post-workout meal, that's still a fairly small meal overall. Well, I guess depending on what your carbohydrate source is, it can kind of vary. I don't know. The fact that he's not feeling hormonal hunger tells me that he's probably good to go with regards to, like, insulin management and all that. But then just that sense of not really feeling full, I'm not super sure on that. Since we're probably looking at bumping up his food pretty dramatically anyway, like, I think that's where he should go to see better performance, then that may take him where he needs to be with regard to that, too. I think he's running a little too lean on this. I think he's running too skinny on calories and would probably benefit from beefing up a little bit. A couple of cheat meals a week versus one whole cheat day, that's just so subjective. I really don't know. It's that thing again where, like, some people never come back off a cheat day. So, like, they actually benefit from really minimizing the cheat meal thing at all. Other people do pretty good with, like, one, you know, like, they'll have some ice cream 3 times a week or something like that, and they're totally good to go with it. It doesn't seem to spin them out. I do find, in general, though, that I know this is true for Nikki, she will start off with, like, getting a dark chocolate bar, and then the idea is that she's going to have one piece of that a day. And then it's just bullshit, because inevitably she ends up in the refrigerator, like, 6 times a day, and she ends up eating the whole thing, and then that starts spinning out into other stuff. Like, I just don't see people regulate that very well. The one nugget of dark chocolate a day just doesn't really play out to me, and that's where I prefer, in general, to just see the cheat meals pop up, usually when you're eating out. It's like you get some creme brulee, you get, like, a chocolate tort, you get some ice cream, you know, whatever, but eat it out, and then you're done, and don't have it at home. And I find that people are a lot more successful in that regard.
For future reference, Rob, I would not talk about your wife when she's in the room listening to you.
Oh, my body will never be found when she finally does snap.
This is why I take the approach of talking about my wife, and I know she'll never listen to the podcast. So as long as she's not around, I'm going to get no rude looks or, you know, kind of askew glances. Like, why are you talking about me?
Well, I'll take that under advisement.
You've been married much longer than I have, so, you know, you may have a better approach. All right, moving on. Question from Greg. One question that he hasn't seen addressed is, what are our thoughts on the alternative options for getting some carbs in besides post-workout meals? For example, I'm thinking about Devaney's style of eating a bunch of fruit at breakfast, or I know there are some more tolerant of carbs at lunch as opposed to dinner. I know it might be simpler to have clients stick to pretty much standard low-carb meals and keep post-workout carbs separate, but is there any logic, in your opinion, to a scaled approach that has higher carbs earlier in the day and less later on?
You know, Devaney kind of does that. It's kind of interesting, you know, like when we did, you know, the very first performance menu issue was an interview with Art Devaney, and that was kind of what kicked off the performance menu, and it also kind of got him back on the internet, like he had kind of fallen off the map, and it got, you know, he opened up his blog and all that. And then a couple of issues later, we did an overview of an interview, I think, with Mauro DiPasquale, and talking about, like, the metabolic diet and cyclic low carb diet. And Art wrote me this just scathing email. He's like, "You're an idiot. These, you know, cyclic low carb things don't work. This is all too structured, and, you know, none of this stuff works. Failure, failure, failure." And I'm just like, Christ, man. I mean, he crawled up one side of me and down the other. But then when you look at the way that he eats, it looks pretty damn cyclic low carb. It's like he's got days where he'll eat a lot of fruit and other days where he doesn't have any fruit at all and he's pretty low carb. And he does it in what he says is an unstructured, natural way, but it qualitatively, I don't see it looking at all differently than, you know, more structured kind of cyclic low carb deal. So I see two potential benefits out of this. Like, I think that throwing some carbohydrate in the post-workout period is a smart, sneaky way to get in some carbohydrates to make you repaired and ready to go for your next training session. Matt Lalonde has commented on this, and he's completely unsold on the need to do this at all, because if you've got upwards of 24 hours for recovery, he doesn't feel like the end stage is any different, other than you end up impacting your insulin sensitivity overall with a high carbohydrate post-workout meal. And so he takes a much more moderate approach. See, the basic deal is, like, if you do carbohydrate and protein post-workout, you repair the muscles faster. But his question is, do you end up repairing them more or better? Like, is the absolute magnitude of recovery any greater? And he's pretty convinced that that's not the case. And this is something that I was thinking about today, which is, you know, how much training stimulus do you need to elicit a given amount of adaptational response? And then how much food do you take in that is going to, you know, potentiate that? And I think there was an old TMAG article where they talked about this, in which, you know, you needed a caloric excess when trying to gain body weight, but more than a certain amount really wasn't going to get you any further down the road. It's kind of an interesting trade-off with all that stuff. So, this may be not answering the question at all, but I think it's just kind of like, however you want to roll with this stuff, I think it's fine. If you find that a high-carb AM meal works well for you, I think you're good to go. Pulikan would be horrified by this because he wants to see you do a hunk of protein straight out of the gate because it establishes your kind of insulin-glucagon balance. It establishes a good neurotransmitter status. It's hard for me to imagine a better scenario than like a high-protein, you know, breakfast with some espresso. Like, that just sets the day so good for me. It's really hard to imagine how a big fruit bowl is going to improve upon that. And I've tried both ways. I don't see how that would be, you know, the hunk of fruit early on would be an improvement off of some protein and coffee, but it's certainly there for the tinkering. I still think if you are really trying to push your absolute recovery capacity, like post-workout carbohydrate may be the way to go, but then, you know, it's just all trade-offs. Like, is your focus more on kind of like insulin management, then maybe you don't need the post-workout carb whack or a very, very moderate whack.
Yeah. All right.
There's a lot of variables to it. There's just a ton of variables, and there's no right answer. There's just kind of like, what's the best answer for you and your situation? But there's a ton of variables.
Yeah, that was a good question.
Very good question, yeah.
All right, next up, we've got a question from Mary. She is a girl training with her who was diagnosed with hypothyroidism about a year and a half ago. She's up to 240 pounds at 5 feet 4 inches and has been doing super strict paleo for 6 weeks with limited fruit and about 1x fat intake. She has not lost a pound or any inches. She's been CrossFitting 3 days a week and really pushes herself in the workouts. Her doctor has her on Synthroid and Cytomel, and she has more energy now, and her strength has improved a lot, but she is frustrated with the whack of weight loss. I was wondering if you had any experience with hypothyroidism and paleo.
Yeah, we've had a ton of experience, and usually paleo can help with the hypothyroidism. You know, gluten-containing items, stuff like Hashimoto's thyroiditis and other hypothyroid situations are really, really common within, you know, a grain-based kind of scenario. We just had somebody show up at the door and they're downstairs talking.
And you still haven't oiled those hinges. Damn it, I knew I should have done that.
Not oiled the hinges, need to disarm the doorbell. Sorry, folks. Lost my train of thought. So yeah, we've seen paleo benefit hypothyroid dramatically, like from people being on Synthroid or Armour and then going off of Synthroid and Armour. It doesn't always happen, but it frequently does. From there, but you know, that said, if this individual is on Synthroid and her thyroid levels are in normal, you know, parameters, then we should at least see some sort of forward movement on this. When I hear real strict paleo, that sounds good. I would probably want to see like a 5-day, 10-day meal plan out of that and just see what exactly compositionally we're seeing here. When I see someone say limited fruit, that makes me nervous. The fact that they even mention it makes me nervous because it, you know, it just, when you start dissecting all this stuff, then it's like the limited fruit ends up translating into like 3 bananas and an apple for breakfast and stuff like that. And so I would want to see how much fruit she's taken in. I would want to know what her sleep is like. you know, some stuff like that, because usually we see some pretty good progress out of a person like this. So I would just want to see a little bit more of what's going on.
Yeah. All right. Next question from Drew. Hey, Rob, I've been looking for studies that show the specific mechanism by which high insulin levels cause insulin resistance in the body. Do you know of any studies that explain this, or could you explain it? I've been engaged in a nutritional debate with my nutrition professor at the University of Washington. I'm trying to get them to be more objective in their approach to teaching the 300-level class. As of now, it's basically an extensive course in the USDA guidelines.
That sounds like a party. Nobody knows 100% for sure what's going on with all the stuff. We mentioned earlier that, you know, high insulin levels appear to induce a situation in which you have receptor site downregulation. You know, so it's that perfume analogy that I've mentioned before. You walk into a room, get exposed to real high perfume content, your receptor sites downregulate in response to that, and then your ability to sense the perfume decreases. And so there's kind of a similar analogy in this regard with insulin resistance. We also know that oxidative damage and inflammation damage insulin sensitivity. Lectins, like from grains, legumes, and dairy, appear to damage insulin sensitivity. So this is kind of a multi-factor, multivariate situation in which there's a ton of different things that affect insulin sensitivity. Lack of sleep impacts insulin sensitivity. And the mechanism on this is not super well understood. Cortisol appears to be a factor in it. When cortisol levels start going up, then insulin level, you know, insulin sensitivity decreases. But it's not fully understood exactly what is going on with that. So it's interesting that you have dietary factors, both with regards to just simply carbohydrate intake, that appear to be an issue. But then within that, we look at things like the Catawba study, in which the Catawbans are eating a 60% carbohydrate diet, but no grains or legumes and no dairy, and they appear to maintain really solid insulin sensitivity throughout life. They start introducing any type of lectin containing grains, legumes, dairy, and then they start losing insulin sensitivity and start expressing metabolic derangement and cardiovascular disease and stroke and all that sort of stuff. And then you have a completely non-dietary vector of sleep deprivation that can impair insulin sensitivity. So there's a lot going on here, but for sure, like, if you want to find a group of people who have their head further up their ass with regards to metabolic derangement, you can't find it other than inside the halls of the, you know, standard nutrition, Chico State Nutrition. I had a woman just send me a spicy email because I had given the Chico State Nutrition Department a pretty good tongue-lashing a couple of years ago. And she sent me an email complaining about the unfair treatment and all this stuff. I wrote her an email back saying that, you know, basically they had no science going on, bereft of science, where have we heard that before? But then I backed the whole thing up by saying, if you guys are interested, I'll fund an undergrad and a graduate student to the tune of $1,000 semester to do research that is related to the Paleolithic diet, and I've had no response from these people. So I offered to actually fund undergraduate and graduate students in this topic, and they're so haired out by the notion of paleo that they won't even take money for the graduate students. It's just ridiculous. So that's where, you know, a ton of people shoot me emails wanting to know, hey, what can I do for continuing education in nutrition? Should I do a registered dietitian track? And, you know, it'll get you in the door. It'll give you some anointing to be able to run your own practice. And then obviously you can run it however you want to. But you're going to want to drive an ice pick through your forehead like every day that you were there, because most of what they're talking about is completely wrong. And it's not steeped in any type of they're still kind of scratching around in the dirt. They haven't figured out a all-encompassing theory by which to look at the studies that they're generating. So, I don't know. Drew's got a tough situation there.
I have this image of you, Rob, arguing with college professors all throughout your education process.
Chemistry was pretty laid back in that regard. There's not a whole lot to argue in that camp. So, yeah.
Coming from the guy who once said he'd burn a house down to make a point, so.
Well, when necessary, I will make a point, so.
All right. Moving on, we got question from John, and I enjoyed his little background, so we're going to read it. So, Rob, I truly enjoy your site and podcast, and this is going to come as a shock, but I'm a vegetarian. My wife and I both are, actually. She doesn't eat any dairy either, since she is lactose intolerant. We started it out as an experiment about 2 years ago because my wife has cystic fibrosis and was having a hard time digesting any kind of meat. Her digestion got better, but still not the best due to irritable bowel syndrome, diabetes, and complications with the cystic fibrosis. We have both recently switched our views to more of an ethical reason to not eat meat. Don't worry, I'm not the type to throw red paint and tell people meat is murder. I don't push my beliefs on anyone. So first of all, I want to say, John, we appreciate you reading, and I'm going to quote Mike Boyle, but, you know, disagree doesn't mean dislike. We're more than happy that vegetarians read Rob's blog.
Yeah, even though I poke fun a lot. Yeah, totally.
So, anyway, appreciate the background. So he has two questions. What can help out my wife's digestion? She does eat grains. I tell her to limit it, but she doesn't listen to me often. She eats beans, nuts, fruits and vegetables, tofu, tempeh, quinoa, and we have stopped eating rice.
You know, cystic fibrosis is a sodium pump mutation. So the folks tend to accumulate fluid in the lungs. They have some hydrochloric acid production problems in the gut, in the stomach. And not surprisingly, or at least not surprising to me, there's an autoimmune component to this. So a long time ago, there was a condition, porphyria cutanea tardia, that we became aware of, which is a condition in which people get exposed to sunlight and they get this burn that burns all the way down to the periosteum of the bone. We made people aware of the fact that gluten and transglutaminase is a factor in this, and it helped a bunch of people. And then every once in a while, I'll get somebody, typically from a porphyria support group, and they'll ping me a very snarky blog post, and they're like, porphyria is not an autoimmune disease. It's a genetic disease, and there. And they don't even appear to read the fact that a bunch of people have cut gluten out of their diet and then they're asymptomatic from the porphyria. Cystic fibrosis is similar to this. Professor Cordain has some research in process on this whole thing in which people doing a gluten-free, dairy-free paleo diet end up seeing dramatic alleviation of their cystic fibrosis symptoms. So this is one of those things where it's kind of like I understand these folks are, you know, tackling all this stuff for ethical reasons. What's the book that Eads referenced, The Vegetarian Myth? I'd really recommend that they read that. Give that a shot, because there's this woman who used to be a vegetarian. She's a real staunch feminist and everything, and she pretty well deconstructs the whole notion that vegetarianism is an ethical option or even environmentally superior option. So I would give that a read. And then I would consider for, you know, again, that 30-day buy-in, try doing some sort of a gluten-free, dairy-free paleo diet. And then you know that, you know, you've answered that question. You've turned that rock and you can say, yeah, I look, feel, and perform better. Like the issues related to cystic fibrosis have improved, or they don't. And then you can go on from there. Short of that, or even in conjunction to that, since the digestion is a big issue because of limited hydrochloric acid production in these folks, I would recommend that old standby of the Now Foods Super Enzymes, which has betaine hydrochloride. It's a hydrochloric acid supplement. It also contains things to help you digest protein, carbohydrate, and fat. I would start off with like two of those per meal, but each meal must contain a dense protein and fat source. Must. It has hydrochloric acid. If she's eating a fruit bowl with this, she's going to have significant problems. So I can't be any more clear than that. It must have some sort of dense protein source. Tofu, tempeh, I guess, if she's insisting on continuing to be vegetarian. That's where I would go with that. To the degree that, you know, the quinoa also has a protein fraction in it that can cross-react with celiac. Beans, there's some problems in there. I mean, she has a condition that I would be willing to wager would dramatically benefit, possibly even go into remission with a gluten-free, dairy-free paleo diet, and it would be a month or 2 months of experimentation to be able to answer that question. So I'm very, you know, hard-pressed to find a reasonable suggestion for not at least giving that a whirl, especially when you consider that cystic fibrosis doesn't usually have a a great end stage kind of scenario.
Yeah, and at least consider also, I think the book, The Vegetarian Myth, I think is interesting and thought-provoking for whether you're, you know, a vegetarian or not. I think there's some really interesting, you know, concepts and topics discussed in there.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, second question from John. With her conditions, I know fish oil would be beneficial. What is a good replacement?
There is a kelp-derived. There's some sort of a vegan DHA source. I forget what it is. If you do a little Googling, you can track it down. The DHA can and will interconvert into EPA. If the individual has high insulin levels, that process is slow. Almost inevitably, if folks are eating a kind of standard vegetarian diet, then they're going to have high insulin levels. So that interconversion is going to be limited. So a lot of the anti-inflammatory effects of the fish oil are going to be mitigated in this case. But it's better than nothing. It's a big, big step in the right direction.
Good. All right. Thanks.
And again, you know, like just digestive support, the Now Food Super Enzymes, starting off with about 2 capsules per meal and ramping that up until she feels some heat in her stomach. And then she would dial that back a little bit. Andy and I need to do an actual video on this. I need to draw some stuff and make this really clear what the protocol is, because people can really goof themselves up with it if they do it wrong. So I need to draw this whole thing up, because folks have an amazing way of selectively listening to or remembering a lot of this stuff. So this is pretty important. So we'll try to get that banged out pretty soon.
Now you've done it. You've made a commitment to our 6 listeners. It's going to be an uprising if we don't get that done. All right.
Good. Absolutely.
That was a good question. Rob, we're going to skip the next question. I think we've kind of addressed the coconut thing, although there's a dimension of that we'll come back to, but not this episode. I think it's kind of a broader question. Next, we got a question from Andrea. She saw one of your seminar videos where you talked about Alzheimer's being type 3 diabetes. Can you touch on that in one of your podcasts? Couple reasons for the question. From a hereditary standpoint, my father comes from a family of 3 kids, 3 of which have been diagnosed, including my dad, and another suspect, a sibling who we suspect has Alzheimer's. So my obvious concern is to do whatever I can to minimize the chance of getting it. And is there something that should be done to help my dad? He was diagnosed 2 years ago.
So the Alzheimer's, they call it type 3 diabetes. It's effectively diabetes of the brain. It's very, very common for the individuals with Alzheimer's to have had no real overt symptoms of hyperinsulinism throughout their life. And the most obvious example of that would be obesity. So these folks tend to be comparatively lean their whole lives. It's like, oh yeah, we had, you know, my Uncle Fred or my Grandpa Joe, he ate horribly and never put on an ounce. And then he had Alzheimer's and ended up dying from it. And this is like the just 9.9 out of 10 folks that seem to develop Alzheimer's kind of follow this progression. When you are aware of some of the stuff that Pulikan talks about, the biosignature stuff, the fact that different tissues have different insulin sensitivities and different sensitivities to all kinds of hormones, then this starts making sense. And what we have is that people who are dietarily and environmentally exposed to too high of insulin levels, these individuals, for whatever reason, the main area that they suffer oxidative damage and insulin-resistant type damage is in the brain. It's effectively the blood-brain barrier that is the main site that this starts occurring, and then the oxidative damage occurs in the brain. Best thing you can do, I mean, if we change this again, if we're not talking Alzheimer's and we're talking sunburn, if you've got a sunburn, what you do is you reduce your sun exposure. If you've got Alzheimer's, which is effectively a form of diabetes from insulin resistance, then you decrease your exposure to insulin, which is decreased dietary carbohydrate, you know, and sleep. Take some fish oil. So those are the things that you would want to do to affect some change here. For the father, it's going to be tough. I just find most folks don't change their ways. They're pretty much on the boat that they're going to be. If you want to give it a shot, that's by all means, you know, obviously give it a shot. For her, she should eat a low-ish carb paleo diet, supplement with fish oil, supplement with vitamin D, and make sure to get plenty of sleep in a pitch black room.
Yeah, and then I think the second part of the question is she said she's been working with her mother trying to get her to make dietary changes, discuss zone, discuss paleo with her. Her rebuttal has been, continues to be, it was doctor's recommendations that the elderly need to consume carbs by the way of grains, etc. Can you shed any light on why this is the recommendation? What is the appropriate rebuttal?
probably get, you know, arrested at some point, but her doctor's an idiot and doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, I mean, it's standard American Dietetics Association recommendations, and it's just preposterous. But that's their doctor. They wield the power. So, you know, but as a consumer, essentially a medical consumer, you do have the right to be educated, and you do have the right to ask questions. And she also has the right to try to shop around and find a doctor that is more amenable to helping her parents try alternative paths with this. And if you could get the doctor to sit down and walk him or her through these metabolic processes, usually you can get some sort of grudging acknowledgement on their part that's like, yeah, okay, this does make sense. But then we start dealing with the standard of practice type stuff in which the doctor needs to effectively follow what the AMA, ADA recommend. And if they don't, then they're pretty much hanging their fanny out in the breeze with regards to liability. And so we're very much in a rope-a-dope on that. You know, it's also, I think, you know, my parents came from a generation in which the doctors knew everything, and they just completely acquiesced all of their you know, control of their lives and livelihood to the medical establishment. So the doctor knows all. The parents aren't going to take any type of active role in their health. It sucks, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I think my second book plug of the episode is the Dr. James Carlson. I think he's a doctor in, I want to say, New Jersey or New York. I believe he's a doctor and a lawyer. He wrote the book titled Genocide, How What Your Doctor Doesn't Know About Nutrition is Killing Us, or something along those lines. Very interesting read. He's not strictly paleo, but pretty close, and I think he addresses some of these kind of things with the medical field and some of the challenges and things from that perspective. And you know, his practice is mostly, you know, it's low carb kind of, et cetera, et cetera. So I think an interesting book for folks to check out.
Yeah, and you know, that genocide analogy, Greg Glassman years ago on the old CrossFit.blogspot.com made a commentary that was essentially, you know, our nation's dietary practices and dietary recommendations from the American Dietetic Association, American Medical Association, they kill people. They kill people early. They don't fix much of anything. And the rate of death is on par with what you would see in a genocide situation. I forget what statisticians, you know, cut that off at, you know, like 300,000 people in a year or a million people in a year or something like that. But we're there. We're absolutely there. And you sound like a crazy person when you say this stuff. But sometimes the crazy notion is actually the right notion. So,
all right. Good question. Next and final question, Rob. We have made it.
Woohoo!
All right. Interesting question from Michael. Hi, Rob. Your podcasts have blown me away, though I'm not in what I take to be your intended audience. Still, I'm a person who must fit the description of many clients of the trainers in the audience. I am not a serious athlete. My goal was simply to maximize my physical and mental health and longevity. Nutrition, good meats, veggies, modest nuts and seeds, few cheats. He can do that. Sleep, lots. Exercise. Ironically, your podcasts have not clued me in on this yet. What do you recommend in terms of exercise to maximize the chances for living comfortably to an advanced age? P.S. I'm trying to ask a general instance question, but please address it to the full range of ages. For example, he's 50-ish.
Really good question. And, you know, the intent of the podcast, and we're constantly working to balance this, really is the generalist person. Like, we touch on some fairly high-end topics and get a little long hair on this stuff, but the reality is that there's just a lot of complexity to this stuff. And so we have to get into a little anatomy, physiology, training theory, and all that to just explain what it is we're doing. It's real easy to say, do this, this, and this, but then people ask these pesky questions related to why, and then you kind of have to fill them in, or, you know, like the previous deal where the girl's mother's doctor is telling them to eat a high-carb, grain-based diet, and it gets into a lot of why to be able to refute that stuff. So we really do want this thing to be as generally applicable as we can while also touching on some of these higher-end topics. But then, you know, this idea of what's kind of an optimized training schedule, especially as you age, John Wellborn and I, we were checking out DaveDraper.com, mm-hmm. and Dave's late 60s, early 70s, I think, and just jacked. Like, he was always a phenomenal bodybuilder, still, like, amazing physique, very, very healthy, has maintained that kind of bodybuilding lifestyle throughout his life. The dude maintains a ton of muscle mass, a great metabolic profile. You know, when you look at people who age effectively, but I think we're also, unlike like the Roy Walford approach to aging, the guy that was in the Biodome deal and he was a caloric restriction guy, he was tackling this from a caloric restriction standpoint, and the guy was emaciated, you know, nothing short of emaciated. And so I think that everybody is looking at this from a perspective of I would both like to look good naked and, you know, live healthy and be, you know, of old age. And so you start looking at some stuff, and it starts looking a lot more like some sort of variable bodybuilding approach with, like, some intensity work occasionally, some long, slow ambling work occasionally. Dan John's been writing about this stuff a bunch. Rutherford has talked about and has written about this stuff a bunch. You know, maybe as some sort of a theoretical template, you might say that you would have, like, two solid strength days a week. Maybe like a full body deal, or maybe a split kind of program. Two, you know, metabolic sessions a week. Metabolic being kind of relative. It might look something like a CrossFit type workout, or it might look like intervals on a rower or swimming or running. And then I think a day or two of really low level ambling activity. What that, you know, that fills up your week, that 6 days a week of training being held in quotations, but there's a ton of variety there, and no single day is getting a massive amount of overlap from the other days. They're all quite distinct and very unique in the type of metabolic demands that they impose upon you, and also what type of adaptations you're going to get from them. I know for myself, some of my danger that I've faced in my training is that everything slides so much towards that kind of higher intensity side that you never really do anything else. Like you can slide into a deal where you never really lift heavy, but yet you never really get out and just walk and hike around for 3 hours at a time. And I think that that's a great mix in all this. Like, and you know, you look at what Art Devaney does. Here's something to contemplate. It just kind of popped into my head. What is the nutrition approach? What is the lifestyle approach? What is the training approach that has worked for Art Devaney, Mark Sisson, Michael Rutherford, and can you think of anybody else kind of in that like 50 to 70 year, you know, like Clarence Bass?
Yeah, I was going to say, don't leave out Clarence Bass.
Clarence Bass. Dave Draper might be a good example, but I think he's a little bit more on that bodybuilder side. But if we deconstructed their diets, it tends to be pretty high protein, plenty of vegetable matter. Clarence Bass tends to be a little bit on the high carb side for me, but you know, it's worked for him. The dude's always been very much aware of good fat intake and all that sort of jive. He had kind of a bad experience doing what he thought was a low carb diet, but it was an all protein deal. Like, he didn't have any fat, and that was back years ago. Mm-hmm. And nobody's ever been able to get him to try like a low-carb approach since then. Rob Fagan's tried, a bunch of other people have tried, and he just won't go near it. But that's kind of neither here nor there. But basic deal is like unweighed, unmeasured, good food. Like, you know, that's been his approach. It's been Devaney's approach, Sisson's approach, Rutherford's approach. And then let's look at their training. It typically has been, you know, challenging, but rather modest also. Like, Rutherford has competed at a high level in Olympic weightlifting several times. He has national championship in there. But he will peak in O-lifting, and then he'll shift into an interval running stage of his training. And then he'll shift into what, for all intents and purposes, looks like a bodybuilding phase of his training. And the guy at 50 years old is like 200 pounds and probably 8% body fat. and can whoop some ass on about anybody else, you know, age group, and you match him up at about any type of event, and he's going to do pretty damn well. Devaney has some great performance parameters, great body composition. Mark Sisson, same deal. And then you can let's look at some other people who advocate diet and lifestyle activities that they can't even follow their own prescriptions. I don't think Barry Sears exercises or follows his own. And there are some other coaches of notoriety that don't follow their own exercise prescriptions or nutritional approaches. And this is something that Poliquin made a big point, because I asked him, actually Poliquin at the BioSignature thing, I asked him a similar question to this, and he actually got kind of frustrated with me. He was kind of spun up about the whole thing, and he's like, you need to figure out who you are and what you like, and then find what you can do over the course of a lifetime. And it needs to be challenging, and it needs to be fun. And interestingly, like, Poliquin eats a low-carb paleo diet, kind of cyclic low-carb paleo diet, and he lifts heavy weights, and he essentially does, like, a power bodybuilding deal. And in his late 40s, the dude is jacked. He has a phenomenal performance. I don't know what his Fran time is, but he looks, you know, good in a bikini, and I think could probably whoop ass on most people. So I think finding something that is sustainable, challenging, reasonable, and I think some sort of a template that ends up looking not too far afield from a little bit of bodybuilding, a little bit of sprint work, and then a whole lot of fun. Seems like it would be a real good spot to be at with an aging athlete sort of scenario.
Yeah, and it seems like most of those folks, I mean, if I was to think about it, I mean, they're all strong. Strong being relative, right? I mean, those guys are really, you know, most of those guys that you talked about are really strong, I think, in an absolute fashion for their age group, but they're, you know, relatively strong. Super mobile and flexible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously they have a fair amount of capacity. But I guess I would argue for most of the folks, if I looked at kind of, you know, what my parents have gone through that didn't work out for a long time, and then in their late 50s, early 60s started exercising, you know, they got the bigger bang from their buck for, you know, kind of increasing the relative and absolute strength. They're by no means strong, but relative to their age group, and, you know, worked on getting them moving better, get some of their flexibility and mobility back. And then when I think about, you know, Bass or Sisson or any of those guys, how they're handing that work capacity stuff, you know, it's some type of interval-ish, you know, intensity being relatively high, but, you know, it's, you know, for most of those folks, probably not high compared to some of our, you know, pipe-hitting 22-year-old CrossFit athletes.
Right, right, which is the same thing that you kind of see extrapolated across all age groups. When you go to a Masters Jiu-Jitsu tournament, Masters Track and Field tournament, you kind of see a similar deal, and the people who do real well with it are usually real very, very good at figuring out where their kind of B-level, B-plus gain is, and maintaining that instead of driving into that attempt at the A-plus or elite level. The reality is elite performance of whatever flavor you want to look at, the return on investment starts costing you, and that's just an absolute fact of physiology and biology. I think the legit kind of longevity orientation, it's that good enough is. Like a B plus is good enough, because orthopedically, metabolically, hormonally, it's giving you everything you want without really taking too much away from you.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, all this to me comes back to, and I think, you know, Ripito would agree with this. I know Cressy made something similar, a statement along this, where basically said, you know, for most folks, I don't care who you are, whether you're an athlete or you're my grandma, you know, probably strength is the most important quality to build and maintain over time.
Absolutely. Yeah. And within that strength, I think is implicit this full range of movement,
yep,
kind of concept, which then brings us around to mobility and all the rest of that stuff. And it starts becoming very synergistic or multidimensional when you've got to focus on the strength and mobility side of things. Then the ability to build work capacity is kind of it's just a downhill slope from there.
Yeah, and I think for Michael, for folks around this age, you know, things I think we would both agree that we would love generally is like things like sled dragging. You know, as we get older, heck, I'm only 32, but got some joint stuff, and, you know, things for work capacity like sled dragging, I think, you know, it's phenomenal for my knees and hips. You know, I can row, so I like to row. You know, not, if you look at Sisson and all those guys, none of them are really running at their age.
Right, right. Or if they are, I know Devaney used to be a big fan of, like, the 5x100, 10x100 sprint day and stuff like that. You know, you get out and get warmed up thoroughly and then do build-ups on the sprints, full recovery, all that sort of jive. Yeah.
Yeah. No, great question, Michael. Good stuff.
Yeah.
All right, Rob, with that, we're wrapping this up. This is the longest episode ever recorded, but I was committed to getting through most of the questions today.
Well, folks can chop it in half and listen to it in pieces, so...
Yeah, all six. Hopefully we'll have all six when we come back next week. But with that, that is episode 10. Rob, I thank you for your time, and you have a good afternoon.
Thanks. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, see ya.